I'm Andrew O'Hagan, host of a new podcast from the London Review of Books. It's about the bloodiest and most controversial event of the Falklands War, the sinking of the General Belgrano. Margaret Thatcher was accused of a war crime. The truth would only emerge in the pages of a private diary. This is the Belgrano Diary. Listen wherever you get your podcasts.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds.
Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous two-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
You're listening to the London Review of Books podcast. My name is Thomas Jones. Today I'm talking to Rosemary Hill, a contributing editor at the LRB, whose most recent book is Time's Witness, History in the Age of Romanticism. She has a piece in the current issue of the LRB on the 20th century British painter John Craxton. It's a review of a new biography of Craxton by Ian Collins. Hello, Rosemary, and thank you for joining me.
Hello.
John Craxton, to the extent he's thought about at all, is now seen as a peripheral figure in 20th century British art. And of all the artists you mention in your piece, he's possibly the least famous. But that wouldn't have been predictable in 1944, say, would it? When, as a young painter full of promise, did he seem destined for greatness?
Well, he was part of that generation that came up with Lucian Freud, who was his exact contemporary, and also a younger contemporary of Graham Sutherland. And he was seen very much in that way as part of the, particularly in the post-war period, because he really launched himself during the war. He couldn't fight. He escaped conscription because he was just too kind of thin and ill-looking. The army took one look and said, no, thank you. And by the time the war ended, and everyone, of course, was looking for new starts and new hope, he was very much part of what post-war art was going to be with the others, with Moore and Hepworth. And yet now, as you say, he has been very largely forgotten, which is why I think Collins' biography is such a welcome arrival.
And he was classified as a neo-romantic.
Well, that was the real, I have to say, having always liked Craxton's work, when I came to this book, I did very much have him in my mind as part of the neo-romantics. Minton, Ayrton, Craxton, they all were bracketed together. They still are really bracketed together in English art history as it is written, as part of the post-war neo-romanticism, this idea that one way of getting over the horrors of the war was to return to an English pastoral tradition, the tradition of Blake and Samuel Palmer. And Craxton admired Samuel Palmer very much, but he certainly wasn't really neo-romantic, but somehow his reputation got stuck there. And there was a big exhibition in 1987 in London about the neo-romantics, as they were called, which kind of pinned poor Craxton into that moment, which really wasn't true, because apart from anything else, as he said himself, he complained very much about the exhibition. He wasn't, I mean, apart from anything else, everyone else in that grouping, apart from Craxton, by the time the exhibition happened, they were all dead. I mean, he was partly a different generation, but mainly just a different temperament. He wasn't a romantic. He didn't long for anything that he didn't have. He had a very happy life full of all the things he wanted, which were basically Greece and sunshine and on-off love affairs with Greek sailors and lots of friends and just about enough money.
But the influence of Samuel Palmer, William Blake, if you look at, I don't know, an early painting like Landscape with Poet and Birdcatcher, from
yes,
the early 1940s, you can look at that and you can see Palmer and Blake in it. But was that neo-romantic label sort of imposed in that 80s exhibition? Was he already described in that way in the 50s?
He was already, I think, seen like that. And the problem with his reputation being, there, I think there are two questions really, aren't there? There's, is he underrated, which I think he is to a certain extent, though perhaps not quite so much as his very loyal biographer does. But the other point is he just kind of misfiled? Is he in the wrong box in art history? And that, I think, is certainly true, because in a rather... I mean, certainly, of course, he was influenced by Palmer, and he was always interested in landscape, but he moved away from the British landscape, the English landscape, with all that kind of rain-soaked, memory-soaked history for the much brighter, harder surfaces that a Greek landscape presented him with. But I think it was just that he moved away. He went away. He didn't work at his reputation. He lived largely outside England for as much of his life as he could. And so he was sort of forgotten, because his contemporaries who were in that neo-romantic exhibition, Lost Paradise, those were early pictures that were shown then, and it was understood that they had moved on. Whereas, as I say, Craxton in the public memory got stuck.
And as if we go back to a bit of biography, that he was born in 1922, sort of an exact contemporary of Lucian Freud, as you said, and he grew up, and I have to say that actually he was the son of Harold Craxton, whose name was familiar to me before John Craxton's was as the editor of Beethoven's piano sonatas, but he was also a pianist and piano teacher, and John was one of six children in this chaotic household in St John's Wood.
Yes, I mean, it was obviously a very shambolic family, and the difference, because I hadn't heard of Harold Craxton, only of John, and there in itself is a kind of lesson about how fame actually works. And they were all... Harold had been a great accompanist to all the big Edwardian divas, but he'd never had any formal qualifications. And indeed, his son never got any formal qualifications. And the whole household seems to have operated on a kind of moral economy of happiness. Essie, his Craxton's mother, who somehow managed to keep all the... she managed to keep the finances just about together. And they were very good at finding the right person, the right opportunity at the right time, though not necessarily in the right way.
And that opportunity for John Craxton came through the magazine Horizon, and in particular Peter Watson, right? So who was a family friend?
He was one. Well, the house was always full of people drifting in and out. I mean, at the age of eight, Essie had managed to introduce her son to Mortimer Wheeler, who was the most famous archaeologist of the day, because John had shown an interest in archaeology. And later on, he met Peter Watson through somebody who was lodging in the house. And that was his big break, really, because it brought him out into the world. And Peter Watson was an amazingly kind, tolerant, wealthy supporter to a number of artists, and indeed to that whole... He was central to that whole Horizon group, who had huge influence in framing the post-war English cultural scene.
Yes, that was Cyril Connolly and Stephen Spender and...
Yes.
Yeah,
that
none of them.
Whole set. And also, but very much poets, artists, writers all in together. It wasn't a kind of narrowly literary or narrowly artistic world. And Craxton thrived on it. He was incredibly sociable. Everybody enjoyed his company. Everyone was pleased to see him. And that did him no harm at all.
And so his interest in Greece began before he ever went there, didn't it? Through his interest in archaeology.
Through the interest in archaeology, and he discovered the Pitt Rivers collection at Oxford, and he saw Cycladic art, and it somehow immediately spoke to him. And later on he said that one of the interesting things about Greek art, particularly mosaic, Byzantine art, was that it had discovered what the cubists later thought that they had invented. About how you could internalise perspective. And this was something, as he was, Craxton was hopeless at school. He was sent to all these progressive schools where he made no progress at all and was just endlessly expelled. But it was because he knew what he wanted to do. He wanted to paint. He wanted to go where these art forms were, which he discovered was Greece, principally. And everything else just didn't make any impact on him.
And he was a terrible speller as well. Yes,
his spelling of schizophrenic has to be seen to be believed. But no, his friends referred to his spelling as Anglo-Craxton. But he was a great communicator, so the spelling thing didn't matter.
And he started painting scenes that he sort of claimed to be in Greece, right, before he ever went to Greece. There was scenes that he would take, as it were, they were Welsh landscapes that he then called Greek fishermen and things
yes.
like that.
Yes. Well, he had to improvise. I mean, it was very unlikely that he would have gone as a child to Greece, and he certainly didn't. It would have been very difficult for the family to do that. And then, of course, the war came, so it was impossible. So he had to make it up, but then, you know, that's what artists do.
But then as soon as he could, I mean, he did go to Greece in 1946, so pretty much as soon as he was able to after the war finished.
Yes, and this was long before package holidays. There was a civil war going on. And he was absolutely physically fearless because it was dangerous to travel in Greece. But one of the things that protected him was that he spoke very good Greek, apparently very peculiar Greek, which he learned from the chauffeurs at the British Embassy. I mean, it was very typical of Craxton's combination of high bohemia and low bohemia, if you like, that he got to Greece because he met at a show opening, an exhibition opening in Zurich. He met the British ambassador's wife, and he's the wife of the British ambassador in Athens. And he said... he wanted to go to Greece. And she said, well, she just remembered that she'd left a bomber that she'd borrowed. She wanted to go to London to get new curtains for the embassy. Anyway, she'd left this bomber in Milan. And if he wanted a lift back to Greece, he could come with. So he did. And but at the same time, and he learned Greek from the chauffeurs in the Greek embassy, because the ambassador himself was not so keen on having Craxton in the embassy, so he had to move out to the staff quarters. And because he spoke this very fluent, demotic Greek, and was very charming, he often managed to get himself out of very difficult situations, which others didn't. Travelling in Greece during the Civil War was extremely dangerous, whoever you were.
When Byron was in Italy, supposedly he spoke sort of incredibly fluent Italian in one sense, but it's completely ungrammatical, but he was able to speak it at great speed and with a wide vocabulary, and that and his charm.
Yes.
He got by.
Certainly Craxton's Greek caused people to wonder where on earth he had come from. One of the maids in one of these grand houses, when he rang up, said there was a lorry driver on the line. She couldn't believe. And he used to frighten, when he was in London, he used to frighten waiters in Greek restaurants by suddenly letting fly with this great stream of demotic obscenities while they were explaining what a kebab was. Great charm, but also he was genuinely very interested in people. He lived with, you know, took rooms with all sorts of people, many of them very poor. He was used to living in a household where there wasn't much money and everyone had to pull their weight. And he won the trust of the people he stayed with because, as I say, because he spoke their language.
Yeah. And the effects on his painting, the painting that we reproduced in the paper with your piece, is Hotel by the Sea, which he painted in a Greek landscape that he painted in Greece rather than Wales.
Yes.
And the difference in the light?
Oh, the light
is that something you can sort of see immediately in the painting?
Yeah, the light is everything. And I don't think, even if he'd wanted to, he could have gone back. I mean, you see it in painters sometimes, that if they move geographically at a certain point in their life, the light changes forever. And as I say, even if they want to go back, they can't. It was what he was looking for, and he found it, this bright, hard light. Hard perspective, not the kind of misty perspective you get in more northerly latitudes. And that influence of mosaic, he never actually worked in mosaic, but he studied mosaics and travelled very widely looking at Byzantine mosaics. And that was what his art was. And he says, you know, I didn't really think about colour, the colours just land. And his difficulty really was the fact that everything he looked at was so beautiful. And I think that became perhaps, I think in some ways that made it more difficult for him. I mean, the pictures kind of made themselves. So what was he to do? And I think that the sense, a lack of, slight lack of bite or kick or whatever you want to call it, that people began to see in his work after the 50s, the later 50s, when he was mostly in Greece, I think it's the terrible cliche that happiness writes white. And I think he was happy, it was beautiful, something went out of the art, but that lived in the life.
This is the LRB podcast. If you enjoy listening to it, you'll probably enjoy reading the London Review of Books. To subscribe from just £1 per issue, go to lrb.me/listen. That's lrb.me/listen. Or click on the link below.
You write about Craxton's playfulness in his paintings, the way that he'd hide the date of a painting on a beer bottle or work his signature into the pattern on a cigarette packet. I mean, is that, along with the sort of this lack of horror, as it were, compared to
Francis Bacon
or Lucian Freud, contributes to that?
Absolutely. I mean, he didn't. That was another way in which he wasn't a romantic. He wasn't tortured. I mean, in fact, he had very great difficulties and sadnesses in his life from time to time. He was very close to his sister, Janet, and she died. It wasn't that he lived a blissful, trouble-free life, but he didn't. His temperament was, his default mode was happiness and cheerfulness, and he didn't believe in taking anything, including art, too seriously. And that, of course, was not fashionable, particularly not to a world that was looking at these very tortured images of Bacon and Freud. And there was little Johnny Craxton having a ball on Crete. It didn't cut the same amount of ice.
And his outsiderness, the fact that he was sort of happy on Crete rather than miserable in London, so physically, geographically at the margins, but also at the margins of 20th century British art, more
yes,
metaphorically as well. And is that something that you find appealing about him? I was thinking that in Time's Witness you write not about neo-romanticism, but about a number of antiquaries in the age of romanticism in the early 19th century. Many of those people could be described as sort of outsider historians. So do you find Craxton's outsiderness contributes to his appeal?
It does to me. And the fact, his complete lack of pomposity, his lack of taking himself too seriously. And of course, one reason why he wasn't more famous was that he didn't. I mean, fame has a lot to do with wanting to be famous. And he didn't particularly. He wasn't that bothered. So he didn't build his reputation in a way that he certainly, because he, you know, as we discussed, he either knew or knew how to get to know practically anybody. But he wasn't ambitious in that sense. And so he liked being where he was and stayed where he was happy rather than, or for as long as he could, rather than ploughing a sort of steeper furrow of reputation, connections, and fame.
But he did continue to make famous friends, didn't he? Patrick Leigh Fermor, for example. Did they meet in Crete or in Greece at any rate?
Yes, they met. He'd always known people who were famous. I mean, he had a great intimate friendship and for a while a love affair with Margot Fonteyn, because he was a man who absolutely loved women and female company. And sometimes, although he was mainly gay, that sort of extended into a love affair with sex for a while. And then he was dismayed by Margot Fonteyn's ill-advised, as he saw it, marriage and her later unhappiness. But he was capable of these great, intense friendships. But he wasn't really all that bothered by whether people were famous or weren't. He was more bothered about, I mean, again, his life was very much a continuation by other means of that Craxton family home, where there were some very famous people, but there were a lot of people who weren't famous, who were just there because people liked them and they got on. And that, I think, was his guiding star rather than getting on.
Yeah, and there's a photograph of him on a beach with Patrick Leigh Fermor, sort of I don't know, mucking around as if they're having a really nice time.
Oh, well, there was a lot of mucking around, and they were dancing, doing a kind of parody of the Zorba, the Greek dance. Yes, I mean, they were very happy.
Yeah, but there was a sort of professional relationship there as well, some of the covers of Lee Fermor's books were done by Craxton.
And
were they done specially for the books, or were they paintings that were there?
No. He was a very good illustrator. He was a very good theatre designer. That was how he met Margot Fonteyn, because he designed ballet sets. And again, he would turn his hand to many things. He wasn't too grand to do anything. I mean, he took it very seriously, that work, but he also enjoyed the theatre. Frederick Ashton admired his work. So it was, he was very versatile and he liked the theatre. He was also, not surprisingly, very musical. So that was another pleasure.
And then, of course, there was the relationship with Lucian Freud, which can very easily come to dominate any account of Craxton. And it's,
yes.
It'd be quite nice not to talk about him without mentioning Freud at all, but I looked Craxton up in the LRB archive and found two mentions of him from 40 whatever years before your piece in the current issue, which I suppose gives a rough indication of his lack of fame, if mentions in the LRB could be an index of that. And one was in a piece that you wrote about Elizabeth David in 1999, and the other was in a piece by Nicholas Penny on Freud from 1988. But there's no mention of Craxton in Colin Tobin's review of the first volume of William Fever's biography of Freud, or in Celia Paul's response to the second volume. And is that an indication of the extent to which Freud sort of pretended that he and Craxton hadn't been friends? They had been very close and they lived together, and then Freud sort of came to deny him completely, almost.
Yes, I mean, it's a great irony, and I think Ian Collins handles this very well in his book, because he doesn't let it dominate, but it was... Craxton's career is kind of bracketed by these two relationships with Freud. The one at the beginning, during the war, when they were both poor and starting out, and, well, in their late teens, and were very close, were very intimate, worked on the same pictures together sometimes, drew and painted each other a lot, made the neighbour's life absolute hell with a lot of drinking and shouting. And because, at that point, everyone was buying Victorian pictures for the frames, and they used to buy Landseers and things and rip them out. And then there was this terrible crunching of broken glass, which was annoying for the people downstairs. But this very intense friendship, then, as such intense friendships tend to, over time, obviously Craxton was mostly not in England anymore, it just drifted apart, it seemed, at first. But when Craxton came back, I mean, he was chucked out of Greece at one point under the colonels, because his reckless charm and endless jokes at the expense of the local police eventually proved too much for a totalitarian regime. So he had to leave. And when he reappeared, by the time he reappeared, Freud, of course, who was a compulsive myth-maker about his own life, had moved on. And Craxton wasn't resentful of that. He says rather charmingly, Lucian dropped me when he found a better painter, meaning Francis Bacon. And that was fine. But what he couldn't accept was that Freud wouldn't accept that their past relationship had ever existed. And he went to great lengths to shut Craxton up, to say that pictures that Craxton said were by Lucian and Craxton together weren't. He had pictures taken down from exhibitions. He didn't want Craxton meeting up with his new grand friends. And of course, Craxton, who wasn't really, that was what got him into so much trouble in Greece, he wasn't really in awe of anybody. And so when he looked at Freud's paintings, he did occasionally say he didn't think the perspective was quite right. And it was so long since anyone had spoken to Freud like that, of course. That didn't go down well. And the other thing which Freud couldn't bear was that Craxton was very vocally critical of the way that Freud treated women. Because Craxton, as I say, Craxton loved women. He had a lot of women friends and occasional female lovers. And he really disapproved of what he said was Freud's kind of well, misogynistic, he described it in the end, use and treatment of women. So Freud just did everything he could to make it seem that Crackston was just kind of, you know, a sad wannabe who was clinging on to his more famous friend, who'd never really been his friend anyway, just an acquaintance. And because I think, who knows why, but Natasha Spender said it was slightly Crackston's own fault that he let himself become so obsessed with this. And he did, I suspect, because actually people who are not malicious, and Crackston was not malicious, and he was fundamentally fairly truthful. He could be very unreliable, he could be very selfish, but I don't think the way that Freud behaved, I think he was baffled, probably. I don't know. But perhaps as much as anything, just baffled by what on earth was going on.
Yeah, I mean, the more you hear or read about Freud, the more he comes across as a complete monster, really.
Gasp.
And Crackston, you know, very much doesn't. But did that... I mean, presumably if Freud's treatment of him and determination to shut him out must have contributed to the waning of Crackston's reputation,
yes,
and his sort of eclipsing.
Absolutely. Well, certainly if you think of it the other way around, if Freud had said when Crackston found himself chucked out of Greece, had welcomed him and chosen to promote his work, he could have done a lot for him, or he could have just done nothing. But he did instead try to, as I say, positively squash Craxton's reputation. But then, I don't know, did Craxton mind about the reputation thing that much? I'm not sure. He minded desperately, as I say, being miscast as a romantic. And he also didn't, I mean, Derek Jarman wanted to make, and this is the other thing, because people want to appear in their own way, but Jarman wanted to make a film about Craxton, and Craxton said nay because he didn't want to appear in a dream sequence with a lot of sailors, which, as Colin says, is rather ironic, really, as he'd spent most of his life in a kind of dream sequence with a lot of sailors. But, so, I think he, in the end, Freud could have helped and didn't, and did hinder, but Crackston just wasn't interested enough in being famous.
Yeah, whereas Freud was very interested in being
famous. Well,
Freud,
I mean, Crackston has this extraordinary phrase about how Lucian hangs well in his private angst academy. Yes, Freud was desperately, his life's work really was his life. And Crackston, couldn't be bothered, really. I mean, one warms to him the more you think about it. And he just, it's almost like a parable, the two of them. And, of course, Craxton's life, well written though it's been, I mean, it's a great argument. As someone who's written a biography and a book with a lot of biographical portraits in it and has never wanted to deal with anyone who's even in living memory, because it's such a nightmare. But Collins makes a very powerful case indirectly for writing the life of someone you've known, and he knew Craxton well in the last part of his life, because Collins does capture all those very ephemeral things about his humour, about his warmth, the trouble he would take to do things like giving children a ride on his motorbike, or in the most sweet detail that when he was too ill to drink Armagnac anymore, and he was quite a heavy drinker, but he couldn't drink it anymore, and he would just put it behind his ears like scent. And that's just so engaging. And so I'm very glad that this life, the kind of butterfly life, has been caught so beautifully.
But it did, I mean, Freud's rejection of him, and not in terms of what it did to his reputation as a painter necessarily, but simply, presumably, personally, that this person, they had been very close, they had been very good friends. At one point, they'd been closer to one another than to anyone else. And the total rejection did rankle, didn't it?
It more than rankled, I think. It sort of became an obsession. And because also Craxton, as he moved through life, having all these various on-off love affairs, some more casual than others, and ultimately a civil partnership, but he tended to stay friends with everybody. I mean, it wasn't, though, again, you know, not very romantic. There were no terrible hair-pulling scenes and hysterics. And so I think, Yeah, I think he was just, he was baffled and obsessed and unfortunately obsessed. And so when he was very ill and the consultant said to him, what are your priorities for the rest of your life? And he said, I must outlive Lucian Freud. And she said, who's Lucian Freud? Which must have been the most wonderful moment for Craxton.
Yeah, he'd die happy. But he, I mean, he didn't out, I mean, Freud outlived Craxton by a year or two, didn't he?
Yes,
so he, you know, even that competition, as it were, Freud won.
He did, but I think, yeah, and Freud will always win the reputation game, but Craxton wins at life.
Rosemary Hill, thank you very much.
Thank you.
You can read Rosemary Hill's piece on John Craxton in the latest issue of the LRB, along with Emily Wilson on Aristophanes, Joanna Biggs on Annie Ernaux, and Rebecca Carl on China's economy. On next week's podcast, the third episode of Irina Dumitrescu and Mary Wellesley's series of Encounters with Medieval Women on Chaucer's Wife of Bath. This episode was produced by Eliane Glazer. The music is by Kieran Brunt. The producer of the LRB podcast is Anthony Wilkes. And I'm Thomas Jones.